Today is Wednesday, April the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump criticizes the World Health Organization for its virus response.
They called it wrong. They called it wrong. They missed the call. They could have called it months earlier.
An update on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. How robots in the age of COVID-19 are standing in for food servers. It's all on today's International Edition. As the number of deaths and infections across the U.S. continue to rise, President Donald Trump Tuesday criticized the World Health Organization for its handling of the pandemic.
They called it wrong. They called it wrong. They missed the call. They could have called it months earlier. They would have known. And they should have known, and they probably did know. So we'll be looking into that very carefully.
Trump said he will put on hold U.S. funding to the World Health Organization over its coronavirus response.
We're going to put a very powerful hold on it, and we're going to see. It's a great thing if it works, but when they call every shot wrong, that's no good.
And defending his administration's response to the coronavirus, Trump falsely asserted that travelers at U.S. airports are being routinely tested for COVID-19. He made accusations against a watchdog and wrongly claimed the Obama administration did nothing during a flu pandemic. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson remained in intensive care with the coronavirus on Tuesday. Former Prime Minister David Cameron said the nation is praying for his quick recovery.
Obviously, it's very worrying news, and all of us are praying for Boris and thinking of him and praying and thinking of his family and hoping that he gets well soon and gets back to number 10, where I know he wants to be and where we all want him to be.
International Edition's Steve Miller got an update on Johnson's condition with reporter Henry Ridgewell in London.
We haven't had any further updates of any detail from the hospital itself. As you say, Prime Minister Johnson was taken to intensive care at 7 o'clock local time yesterday in the evening. He was given immediate oxygen treatment. It hasn't been detailed exactly how that was administered. Doctors are emphasizing that he has not been put on a ventilator, basically a mechanical breathing machine. So his condition has not deteriorated that far yet. They are keeping him in intensive care because they want that equipment to be on hand should his condition deteriorate any further. When the news broke last night of Prime Minister Johnson going into hospital, it was in the evening as people were settling down to watch the television news. It really shocked the nation. You saw an outpouring of wishes, well wishes across the political spectrum and across the world, hoping that he would get better and would soon be out of hospital. For the moment, the Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has taken over the lead of government, although he's not taking any major decisions as yet on the coronavirus crisis. But Prime Minister Johnson has asked him to take over while he tries to recover in hospital.
You say that he's asked Foreign Minister Raab to take over while he's in the hospital. Does that mean that he is, in fact, taking a step back? Because when he went into the hospital on Sunday, he was very much trying to lead the country through the pandemic.
Exactly right, Steve. So throughout this crisis and ever since Prime Minister Johnson was diagnosed with the coronavirus 11 days ago, he's tried to emphasize that he is still able to operate normally as the head of government. He's able to do normal government business. And when he went into hospital on Sunday evening, he had full video links with other members of his cabinet, most of whom, of course, are also stuck at home as well. And he was operating government normally. It does appear now that he has given up those reins of power. However, temporarily, he has asked Foreign Minister Raab to take over. And it appears that the doctors have probably played quite a big role in that decision as well. We all know that if you can take time out of your daily routine to try to recuperate, it generally helps the healing process. I think doctors have now emphasized to the Prime Minister that it's time he did exactly that, took some time off in the hope that his recovery will be faster and he can be back in 10 Downing Street soon.
Meanwhile, hard-hit Italy reported a death toll of 604 on Tuesday, a lower daily tally than the day before, while the number of new cases posted the smallest increase there since March 13th. Australia has had just under 6,000 confirmed coronavirus cases and 50 deaths. Joining us to talk about the response in that country and how it compares to the numbers in the U.S. and elsewhere is Dr. Sanjaya Sanyake, an infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine at the Australian National University.
In the last few days, we've seen that our epidemic curve is heading downwards. So the number of confirmed cases per day is dropping. So that's really good news. And our health services at this stage have not been overwhelmed by the burden of disease.
The number is going down and the hospital's not being overwhelmed. What do you attribute that to?
Probably two factors. So the first one is intensive testing. I believe Australia has the, if not the highest, definitely one of the highest rates of testing in the world. So about 10,000 tests per million people. And if we compare that to the US, say, must be about a week ago or so, I saw some figures saying the US was doing about 313 tests per million people. And of course, that might have changed and that might have ramped up a lot. But certainly in South Korea, we've seen that that was a formula for success because you're identifying people with the infection, you're isolating them and preventing them from infecting other people. So that's been really important. The other factor which has made a difference is the restrictions that our government has put in place. So there's no incoming travellers who aren't Australian residents to Australia, and there's no schools, a lot of businesses, non-essential businesses have shut down. All those social distancing measures are starting to have an impact.
I'm sure you are seeing what is happening in the United States with by far the most cases and likely the most deaths by a pretty large margin. Same basic question. What do you attribute it to? Do you think that the level of crisis that's happening now here in the United States could have been averted by similar actions?
I think certainly the testing, it appears, could have been far more extensive than it was. And as I said before, that would help you identify people who are at risk of transmitting the infection to others. And therefore, if you isolate them, that won't occur. So I think that's a big issue. And of course, putting in the social distancing and isolation measures, which now have been put in. And it, just looking at other countries around the world, when those measures have been put in, including with China's extensive lockdown, it's taken about 3.5 or 4 weeks to really see an impact from that. So there is a lag time. So I'm hoping the US will see that soon.
Any thoughts on what you're seeing as far as the curve in the United States and what could be expected here, given that, you know, we haven't hit the peak and I think there are a lot of fears that they get back to normal as, you know, this could come back?
Oh, yes. And look, even in Australia, where we seem to be on top of things, even if we get the cases down to zero for 2 incubation periods, 4 weeks, there's always a concern because we're going into our winter in June that we could see a second wave of infections, particularly if the government lifts some of those restrictions. So again, I'm hoping with the US in the next 2 weeks or so, we start to see an impact from some of those social distancing measures and other measures that have been put in place. And I think you will also find that, as in many parts of the world, there are some hotspots in certain countries. It's not necessarily a uniform outbreak within a country. Mm-hmm. So as you well know, in the US, it's New York City, New York State that seems to account for the bulk of cases. I believe that New York City, New York State had accounted for about 40% of the deaths so far. So some areas might have a rougher ride than others.
Dr. Sanjaya Sanyake, an infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine at the Australian National University. Russia and Saudi Arabia meet with other countries this Thursday on cutting oil production while they continue a price war that has driven down U.S. gas and oil prices. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo on the talks that could calm prices that declined in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic.
Russian Energy Minister Alexander Novak told Russian television several days ago that the coronavirus crisis is one of the principal causes of what he called the unprecedented fall of world oil prices. This, he maintained, affects the economic interests of the major world nations, including Russia. In a roundtable discussion broadcast on Russian television, President Vladimir Putin suggested that his aim in the current tug of war with Saudi Arabia and other major producers, including the United States, was to cut world production by around 10 million barrels, give or take. U.S. President Donald Trump has tried to broker a solution between Russia and Saudi Arabia, which have each increased production, to try and intimidate the other. Trump said Sunday that he might consider using tariffs to halt the slide of domestic U.S. oil prices.
Tariffs are a way of evening the score. Tariffs are a way of just neutralizing. They have tariffs on us, and we now can put tariffs on them. Am I using it for oil? It's something we can. No. Am I doing it now? No.
Saudi oil analyst Abdulaziz Mikbal told Sky News Arabia that he thought the U.S. will eventually sit down to discuss oil production levels, since the U.S. is one of the principal parties hurt by the ongoing price war. Riyadh will also host a virtual meeting Friday with energy ministers from the group of 20 nations that represent the world's most powerful economies. Khatar Abu Diab teaches political science at the University of Paris. He tells VOA that he thinks both Russia and Saudi Arabia have reached a stalemate in their game of double or nothing, and that each side has come out a loser.
Le Russe voulait profiter de la moment donné pour augmenter la production et aller envahir le marché asiatique.
He says neither Russia nor the Saudis want to lose the important Asian oil market. Russia, he thinks, may be trying to hurt U.S. producers as a response to U.S. sanctions prompted by a gas pipeline to Germany. Saudi Arabia, he argues, is trying to defend its interests in a show of force with both Russia and the U.S. after feeling slighted by what the Saudis considered insufficient solidarity when its Aramco oil installations were attacked by Yemen's Houthi rebels in June. Paul Sullivan is a professor at the U.S. National Defense University. Sullivan tells VOA that he thinks shale producers in the U.S. seem to be the target of the current oil price war. It is much more expensive, he argues, to produce an average barrel of shale oil in the U.S. than to produce an average barrel of oil in Saudi Arabia and in most of the better fields in Russia. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Here are some of the other top stories we are following from around the world. A social media site for scientists and researchers has launched a new forum to facilitate collaboration between COVID-19 experts on research into beating the flu-like disease caused by the novel coronavirus. The site, developed in just 10 days and launched late last week, boosts the visibility of articles, preprints, and research proposals, as well as links to experts. And U.S. singer Pink said Friday she had tested positive for COVID-19 2 weeks ago and has since recovered. The singer is pledging $1 million to relief efforts. Stay with VOA for all the latest on the coronavirus pandemic. Despite federal health recommendations, thousands of Wisconsin voters waited hours in long lines outside overcrowded polling stations on Tuesday so they could participate in a presidential primary election that tested the limits of electoral politics in the middle of a pandemic. The state's Democratic governor had ordered the election to be postponed and extend absentee ballots, but it was overruled after Republicans took the case to the Supreme Court. Here's how one voter described going to the polls.
So I really wanted to check it out for myself. And, we went in at 7 a.m. hoping that the crowds would be less, so we tried to minimize our risk.
Thousands of other voters stayed home, unwilling to risk their health, even as Republican officials pushed forward with the election amid a stay-at-home order. But many voters complained that their requested absentee ballots never showed up. Joining us now for more on how the pandemic could potentially cause more voting issues in this presidential election year is Kyle Condick, managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Thanks for being with us. So we won't know for about a week how many people risk their lives in the state of Wisconsin to make their vote heard. But is there any indication of how it went?
You know, curious to see what the turnout ends up being and whether there were lots of voters who essentially were dissuaded from voting because they had to balance their own personal health versus their right to vote in the midst of a crisis. You know, we've seen so many states push back their primaries. Wisconsin wasn't even the first state that dealt with some 11th hour drama as to whether they were going to have their primary or not. We saw the same thing happen in Ohio, in which essentially the primary was sort of pushed back, or at least people were allowed to vote for several weeks after the primary was originally scheduled. So, you know, we're not going to really know the results until next Monday. I think that this is a situation that we're not really used to dealing with, and one wonders whether we actually have the right infrastructure to allow people to vote safely in the midst of something like this. Or there were pictures of lines in Wisconsin during the voting. There was a now famous photo of someone holding up a sign basically just saying this is ridiculous that this was happening.
Stay at home, but come out to vote.
Right. The Speaker of the Wisconsin House was, you know, urging people to vote, but he looked like he was working in a hospital himself. He had all sorts of medical garb on, and so it was just kind of an unfortunate situation.
It just seems unimaginable that you can tell people they need to stay home, and yet at the same time, this is your chance, vote or don't vote. The president seemed pretty adamant that he's against mail-in ballots, despite him mailing in his own. Does that seem like the only solution to what we could be faced with ahead, given this is a presidential election coming up and there's concern that this virus, even if it calms down in the next couple of months, could ramp back up right in the fall when we're supposed to vote?
Yeah, and I mean, look, some states it's easier to vote than others. Florida's actually a state where I think it is pretty easy to vote, in that there's pretty robust absentee and early voting in that state. Arizona is another state like that. California. We do have a handful of states, five of them, that is all mail-in voting. Those states are all in the western part of the country. But, it looks like some states that maybe don't offer as robust of options may have to think about trying to do that for the fall. And this fight breaks along predictable partisan lines in which basically I think both parties believe that Democrats benefit from higher turnout more so than Republicans do. Whether that's actually true or not, I think is sort of more up for debate. But I think that sort of general belief forms some of these fights. And so we're seeing Democrats pushing for expanding voting options now, which, again, is very much what the Democrats generally support, and Republicans kind of pushing back on that because that's generally something that they don't support. And then the question becomes, what is really the right decision to do in the midst of a pandemic? And I think particularly because we may very well see this thing die down in the summer and then maybe rear its ugly head again right around the time of the election, hypothetically. I mean, who really knows? But it would be, I think, a real shame and a real problem if the November election was compromised in some way because people had to balance their own health versus being able to participate in bedrock foundation of our democracy.
Is there a real concern that if not all states did enact mail-in ballots and this thing ramped up again, that it would tilt the election in favor of Republicans?
It's sort of unclear. And again, I don't, just because I think both parties believe that Democrats benefit when turnout is higher, I don't necessarily know if that's correct. There's some indication that higher turnout in different kinds of states may have a mixed bag for both parties. You know, in the Sun Belt, where electorates are more diverse and if turnout goes up, it may mean that more non-white voters are voting. That might actually help Democrats in the Sun Belt. But in the Midwest, if turnout goes up, it may be that basically more white voters who don't have a four-year college degree are voting, and those voters these days are generally more Republican. And so the high turnout might actually Republicans a little bit more. Again, I think there's some nuance here, but I think the overall point is that you want to make sure as many people who want to participate in the election can participate in the election in ways that are not onerous. And again, if we're in the midst of a public health crisis and we have these shutdowns going on again, it may be difficult for people to vote. And so this is something that I think election authorities and state governments across the country, and perhaps, in fact, the federal government, at least in terms of helping to pay for it, should really be thinking about.
The Democratic primary, it's strongly believed that Joe Biden will be the Democratic nominee for president. Bernie Sanders has not dropped out. How much could his staying in the race with minimal chance of getting the nomination ultimately hurt Democrats' chances of taking back the White House?
I don't know how much it matters at this point. The Democratic race has kind of been put on pause. We'll see what happens when we get the results in Wisconsin. That was a state that was very good for Bernie Sanders in 2016. All indications are that Biden is going to do very well in that state. You know, we won't know until we see the results, but that's what the polling has indicated. And also, I think results from similar kinds of states have indicated.
Kyle Condick, managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. For the billions of Christians around the world, it is Holy Week, the 7 days spanning from Palm Sunday to Easter, along with one-third of the world under lockdown to try to stop the COVID virus. Christians in the Holy Land are preparing for a very different kind of holiday, one that will have to be with virtual services. And that's also the case for the Jewish community. Israel has imposed new restrictions limiting residents to their own cities and, in some cases, their own neighborhoods in advance of the Passover holiday, which begins Wednesday. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The restrictions taking effect Tuesday mean Israelis will not be able to travel at all between cities, and all public transportation will stop until Friday. On Wednesday and Thursday, the entire population will not be able to move more than 100 meters from their homes, and all stores will be closed. In Jerusalem, which has the largest number of coronavirus cases in Israel, the city is being divided into 7 zones, and during the lockdown, residents must stay in their own zones. Until now, residents were allowed to travel freely for grocery shopping and medical needs. In addition, wearing face masks outside the home, which had been a recommendation, will become the law starting Sunday. There have been at least 60 deaths in Israel and more than 9,000 people have the virus. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel faces a critical moment. Netanyahu said that the next week could determine whether Israel continues to control the spread of the virus. He also said, depending on what happens, some of the restrictions could be lifted next month, beginning with the resumption of special education classes. Israeli Army spokesman Jonathan Konrika says troops have been deployed in some cities to help police.
Another type of mission that we are doing is supporting the Israeli police in enforcing curfews and lockdowns and limitations on movement in various parts in Israel. Now, it's important here to emphasize that we are in a support capacity to the Israeli police. This is a police mission where IDF personnel are supporting the Israeli police in terms of manpower.
Meanwhile, Israelis seem most concerned about the shortage of eggs for Passover. Hoarding and increased demand have led to a nationwide shortage. The national airline El Al has sent planes to Portugal and Spain, and officials say the eggs will be on the shelves soon. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The International Labor Organization says the COVID-19 pandemic is having a devastating impact on the world of work, with nearly 200 million full-time employees expected to lose their jobs. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The pandemic is upending an earlier projection by the International Labor Organization that global unemployment would reach 25 million by the end of this year. A new assessment by the ILO warns that figure could be significantly higher if the coronavirus continues to spread uncontrollably. The report says COVID-19 is expected to wipe out 6.7% of working hours globally over the next 3 months. That is equivalent to the loss of 195 million full-time employees. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says the impact of the unexpected disaster is far worse than the 2008 global financial crisis. He says every region in the world is facing the full or partial shutdown of their workplaces, a situation that affects more than 80% of the world's 3.3 billion workers.
The highest figures in percentage terms are being felt in the Arab states, followed by Europe. And up until this point, the lowest income proportionately, I repeat, is in Africa. But if you translate those percentages into absolute numbers, unsurprisingly, the biggest losses are in the Asian Pacific region, the most populous region of the world.
The report finds the sectors most at risk include accommodation and food services, manufacturing, retail, and business and administrative activities. While both global health and the economy are suffering from COVID-19, Ryder says there's no simple trade-off in the kind of rigorous actions to be taken in dealing with the issues.
The magnitude of the economic and social issues we are discussing today are in effect a direct consequence of deliberate policies taken in the field of health. And so we have to integrate our responses and try to address both of these elements in a way which is not simply the zero sum that might be some might see. It's not a question of either saving lives or saving the economy.
The ILO study says governments must support enterprises, employment, and incomes while stimulating the economy and jobs. It says workers must be provided with social protections to help them weather the crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Italian opera singer Andrea Bocelli will perform in an empty Milan cathedral Sunday for a one-off concert to celebrate Easter. Bocelli will sing in the Duomo Cathedral in the center of Milan, which is currently closed due to the coronavirus outbreak. And instead of a crowd in the pews, his audience will watch a live stream of his performance on his YouTube channel. He'll be accompanied only by the cathedral's organist with a set that will include classic songs like Ave Maria. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Wingagne, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Please take care and be well.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and the artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice